You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
The overall dynamic of the book of Exodus is the movement from the forced service of building storehouses, mishkanot, for Pharaoh in Egypt, to the willing service of constructing the tabernacle, a mishkan, for God at the foot of Mount Sinai. The problem with Egyptian slavery wasn't that Israel was forced to work. We were created for work. The problem was that they were working on the wrong project and working for the wrong master. And so in the first panel of the book, which goes from chapter 1 through 13, we learn how Israel was delivered from service to Pharaoh, and in the second panel of the book, we learn how Israel was delivered for service to the Lord. And so the central theme of the book of Exodus is in many ways a tale of two building projects, a tale that contrasts the rebellious human desire to build the city and the Tower of Babel with the covenantal promise to restore the garden sanctuary. And so we've worked through panel one, and the Lord delivers Israel from service to Pharaoh, and so you can see that in your outline. And we now find ourselves in panel two about how the Lord is enabling Israel to serve him. And so the first section of that panel, Israel is delivered through water, just like Moses had been delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, just like Moses was driven into the wilderness, and brought to Mount Sinai, just like Moses had been brought to Mount Sinai. And in the second section, remember, after Moses was brought to Mount Sinai, the Lord consecrated Moses as his messenger. And now we find Israel being consecrated on the mountain of God as his people and being given instructions for what it looks like for Israel to live as his people. And so then within a chapter 19 through 24, that's the second section of the second panel. That's where we find ourselves. In many ways, it's the central section of the book. And so we've been working through this one in a little bit more detail. Chapter 19 recounts how God came down to meet with the children of Israel. It sets the stage for the covenant words that are found in chapter 20 and the covenant judgments found in 21 through 23. And then in chapter 20, we find the 10 words, the first of the two sections into which the Old Covenant is divided. And the remainder of chapter 20 provides a transition to the next major section of the text, the three chapters of specific judgments that are found in 21 through 23. That's where we find ourselves tonight. And then in chapter 24, we find the formal ratification of the covenant, concluding the second section of the second panel, which is one of the most central portions in all of Scripture. And so tonight is our third lesson in which we're working through the judgments found in 21 through 23 and our 21st lesson in the series as a whole. And so digging down a little deeper into the outline, in chapters 21 through 23, you have four basic sections. First, you have legal wisdom from 21, all of 21, and the first 20 verses of chapter 22. You have legal wisdom exemplified in a variety of situations. And then in 22:21 through 23:9, you have moral imperatives in every situation, the imperatives of compassion, respect, and justice. And then in 23:10 through 19, you have the Sabbath and other festivals. And then you have instructions on the occupation of the land of Canaan. So as I mentioned before, so now we are hopefully going to finish the legal wisdom exemplified in a variety of situations and get into the moral imperatives. So as I've mentioned before, the point of this collection of judgments in 21 and 22 isn't to provide a comprehensive overview of all possible situations, but rather to provide wisdom by explaining what to do in cases that illustrate the various principles by which judgment was to be made. So this is selective. It isn't dealing with every possible situation that could arise. It's intended to be selective so that the judges, those who are making these decisions, will have the wisdom that they need to make just and right decisions. So it's selective. It picks particular examples and uses those examples to teach the wisdom that the judges will need to make wise decisions. And so Over the course of the previous two lessons, we dealt with the first thing. It opens with a preface on Hebrew slaves. And as we saw, this was so neat, at least it was neat to me, how the story of the male Hebrew slave and the female Hebrew slave, both of those illustrate. It's a tale of two masters that parallels the relationship that Israel had with God and contrasts that with the relationship that they had with the bad master, Pharaoh. And so even in the giving of these particular judgments, the narrative into which these judgments are placed is not left behind. And so that's the preface to these judgments. And then you have an introduction that deals with capital crimes. And as we'll see, at the end of this section, which we'll get to, Lord willing, tonight, you have another section on capital crimes. And so you sort of have this thing that's called an inclusio. It's like a bracket, right, where you start with something and you end with something. It'd be like if you started a meal with dessert and you ended the meal with dessert as well. That may not be a bad custom to implement. Or if you started it with salad and ended it with salad, which might be even better. But anyways, the idea is that there's a something comes up, right? You have this statement, you have this language about one part of it, and then you get that at the end, and that lets you know where the beginning and the end of the section is. Because in the ancient world, in the Hebrew Bible, they didn't have things like chapter headings like we have today. It wasn't broken up into chapters. It wasn't even broken up into paragraphs in many cases. And so you would have to have these sorts of things in the text to help you know how it was put together. And we'll see that same bracketing sort of thing. It's called an inclusio. We'll see that happen again when we get to the moral imperatives in every situation. The next section does the same thing. So we have some instruction on capital crimes, that is, crimes that are worthy of death. And then we have a whole section on injury. And so it sort of works, and it works in a very logical sequence. You start with bodily injury to humans that is caused by humans. And then bodily injury to humans that are caused by animals. And then bodily injury to animals that are caused by humans. And then bodily injury to animals that are caused by animals. And so we've covered all of that. And so you basically deal with how to think through injury law. And so that is all those instructions are given. And a particular example is given for each of those cases to help the judges know how to make wise decisions. And so tonight we move from cases involving death or bodily injury to cases involving theft or other property disputes. So we move from dealing with bodily injury to dealing with stuff. And I'm hoping that we can at least get started on the moral imperatives in the next section of the judgments. So Exodus 22 and verse 1. If a man shall steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, then he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. So the killing or the selling. So here's what's happened. Here's a man goes and he sees his neighbor's ox and he steals his neighbor's ox. But he doesn't just steal his neighbor's ox. He slaughters his neighbor's ox and he goes to the meat market and he sells the meat. Or he takes the ox and he steals brother RJ's ox. And I take RJ's ox and I go to Philemon and I'm like, hey, this is my ox. I'm a little bit short of money because I want to invest in this other thing over here. Brother Philemon, do you want to buy an ox at a discount? And so I sell the ox to Philemon. And then Pastor John is, you know, exercising oversight over the community. And he notices that RJ's ox is in Philemon's field. And so he goes to Philemon and is like, hey, what gives? Why do you have RJ's ox? And he's like, well, Peter said it was his ox, and he sold it to me, and I thought it was his, and so now he's discovered that this ox has been sold, right? So the ox got sold from one person. So he's sold it, he's stolen it, and you find that out, then he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. Now the killing or the selling, here's why the penalty is so severe. The killing or the selling is inescapable proof of the ill intent of the thief. So if I've already sold it, I can't just say, well, I didn't know who this ox belonged to, so I just thought I would sell it to somebody else, right? I found it out wandering, and I just was keeping it for Brother RJ, right? I can't say that because I've gotten rid of it, right? And I knew it didn't belong to me, and I gave it to somebody else, and I made money off of it. So that is proof that my intent was bad. Now, stealing animals, when animals are out pasturing, cattle rustling is not that hard, especially in the days before microchips. And catching them was really hard. And that's why the penalty is so huge for the theft of animals, because it's a crime that's easy to commit and hard to catch, And so in order to have a deterrent effect, the penalty has got to be very substantial. Because if I steal an ox and I just have to pay back two oxen, it's so easy to steal the oxen that it's still profitable for me to engage in that. Because I'll just not get caught the next time, right? If that's the only penalty that I have to pay. But if I have to pay back five oxen, I'm going to be a whole lot more careful, because even getting caught one time could undo a whole lot of theft. And so that's the idea. And perhaps the greater amount of time for an ox, because it's five times for an ox and four times for sheep, might have to do with the fact that an ox would have to be trained for labor, whereas sheep just sort of, you know, walk around and say, bah, and then you slaughter them for their meat, or you shear them for their wool, but you don't necessarily have to train them to do their thing. And so that's probably why. And that's something for parents as well, that when children do something that's easy to get away with and hard to detect, at times it's appropriate to have a more severe punishment because there needs to be a deterrent that they don't persist in that kind of behavior when the consequences are a little bit higher. They may be more careful to do that in the future. If a thief be found breaking up, verse 2, and be smitten that he die, there shall be no blood smit for him. If the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood shed for him. And this reinforces the radical divide between crimes against persons and crimes against property. Life, even the life of a thief, is more precious than property. So you may need to kill to defend your family, but you should never kill to protect your stuff. That's the point. And so if a thief is, you know, sneaking in the middle of the night into somebody's house to steal stuff, and he ends up dead, then the benefit of the doubt is given to the householder that maybe he thought that there was an imminent threat to his family or his life. Maybe he didn't even intend to kill him in the dark. He was just trying to stop him, and the thief winds up dead. Then the householder is not guilty of murder. But if the sun is risen, and you can clearly see what's going on, and somebody tries to take your stuff, and you respond by killing them rather than by taking the matter to the judges, then you are guilty of murder. And this is actually a very important protection, because without this, you could go and kill somebody, and you could say, well, I caught them trying to steal. And you could literally get away with murder, especially in the absence of the sort of modern forensic techniques that we have that can help recreate the whole situation. And so, if somebody is in your house in the middle of the night, then that's evidence that they had some sort of ill intent. But I can't just, like, you know, go find somebody in the middle of the day and leave the corpse on my property and say, well, they were a thief anyways. And actually, we see this sort of thing in traditional society, in these sorts of situations, that this is not a hypothetical problem. This actually happened, and this is preventing against that. And it also teaches us, and it even teaches you children, that when your brothers and sisters, are you paying attention? Are my children paying attention? Maybe you should put your book away. That when your brothers and sisters, maybe they take your stuff away from you, and rather than taking the problem to mommy and daddy, you respond by striking out and hitting someone and reacting with violence. That's not an appropriate response to someone taking your stuff. Only a threat to your person is to be responded to with violence. A threat to your stuff is to be responded by a quest for justice, but not by lashing out in anger. So this is a lesson not only for judges, but also even for children. For he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. And so this underscores the fact that thieving could lead to slavery. This would be so much more just than our current system, in which the victims get the privilege of paying the government to spend money so that the white-collar thieves that manage so many of our prisons can provide an environment in which the already guilty can become worse. That's how we administer justice. So if I go out and commit a crime against you, then you get nothing, but you get to pay taxes so that other white-collar criminals can profit off of my imprisonment at your expense. That is not a just system of dealing with crime. The biblical plan was that if someone stole, they should make retribution. If they couldn't make retribution, then they should go and work at forced labor until they could. But the benefits went not to the government, not to the prison managers, but to those from whom something had been stolen. Verse 4. And if the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or axe or ass or sheep, then he shall restore double. So if he has not killed or stolen the if he has not killed or sold the animal, so if, you know, RJ just, you know, walks by my field and he sees his ox in my field, right? That's a different scenario than if I've sold it or I've slaughtered it or I've eaten it or done something else with it, because my intentions could be ambiguous. As a quote here from a commentator, since animals, unlike other types of property, are liable to stray. So, you know, if I have my car parked in my driveway and I find it in Philemon's driveway, then it's pretty, I can be pretty confident of one thing. Unless I have a Tesla, my car did not drive itself to Philemon's driveway, right? Cars don't just sort of stray off by themselves. Someone has to drive them there. Now that's changing, but, you know, at least most cars don't just drive off by themselves. And even if it was a self-driving car, someone would have had to hack it and get it over there. There still would be some human agency going on there. The car wouldn't just decide that it wanted a different owner. So since animals, unlike other types of property, are liable to stray, the possibility exists that an innocent party might be accused of theft for having found and confined a straying animal without any intention of stealing it. Alternatively, a thief might claim that the animals came into his possession after straying and were not deliberately taken by him. So I could say, it just so happened that I found, you know, I've got five oxen in my barn and, you know, I just was on Monday, I saw RJ's ox on the road and I didn't want to buy it on the road by itself. And so I put it on my barn. And on Tuesday, Brother Ben's ox was on the road, the same road. It's shocking, I know. And it wound up in my barn. And on Wednesday, Pastor John's ox was, you know, these oxen just walk by my property. Maybe I have a salt lick or something. And I just got that in my barn. And then on Thursday, it was Pastor Scott's ox, and so I just have these five oxen, and they all just happened to stray onto my property, and I was just keeping them for their owners, but I've been really busy and didn't have a chance to return them. So a thief could spin a story like that, maybe not quite that implausible, you know, but that all these animals had just happened to come on by. And so, given these possibilities, the lesser penalty ensures that an innocent party is not punished unduly, and so if the judges think that actually I stole something, and in fact I didn't steal something, then I'm not sold into slavery over their misunderstanding. But I have enough motivation, there's enough risk, that if I find an animal, I'm not going to like keep your ox till you show up looking for it. I'm going to take it back to you so you can get it back to work, right? So there's a motivation both ways so that I'm not like, my life isn't ruined because the judge has made a mistake in this ambiguous case, but I have a motivation to actually solve the problem the right way. And so that deals with intentional theft of animals. Any question about the intentional theft of animals before we move on? Philip.
We differentiated between life-threatening crime versus crime versus, I guess, property. What if they're stealing your inhaler or EpiPen?
I mean, I think the question there would be if you were in immediate need of the EpiPen and the inhaler at that very moment, you know, I think most of the time you would be able to get another EpiPen, you know, so that would be that would be an interesting hypothetical, but I think in practice, I don't know of people who go around stealing people's EpiPens that they have on them. It'd be more likely that you'd steal that from a pharmacy or something like that. Because when someone's, you know, half-used inhaler doesn't really have a resale value. So I don't, as far as I know, maybe there is this hot market in half-used inhalers, but as far as I know, there isn't. And so I think that would be more hypothetical. So you'd have to know more about the situation to know what would apply to that. That is an interesting thought, though. Anyone else? All right, verse 5. It's possible, verse 5 and 6, it's possible where this is going to talk about you putting your animals in someone else's field and they eat it, or a fire catches on and catches on to your neighbor's field. So it's possible that this refers to two methods of clearing out an old field, either by allowing the animals to graze it to the ground or burning it with fire. Both of those were known. Also, the Hebrew word that's translated as graze and the Hebrew word that's translated as burn are spelled exactly the same way, and that links these two scenarios together, which otherwise it's a bit puzzling why they're placed together. If a man shall cause a field or vineyard to be eaten, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed in another man's field, of the best of his own field and of the best of his own vineyard, shall he make restitution. So if you if I put my animals in Pastor Scott's field, and I'm like, you know, go get a good lunch in Pastor Scott's vineyard, and he's got his vineyard going, and I put my donkeys in his vineyard, and they eat all his grapes, then I'm responsible to pay back out of my own vineyard, or out of my own something, whatever I've got to repay the damage that my animals have caused. Now, a possible scenario is that actually my intent was for them to, you know, that maybe it was goats, right? And I had all these weeds, and I wanted the goats to clear the weeds so I could plant I couldn't plant rice in a field. They didn't really have that in Israel. But maybe I was forced by necessity to plant some wheat or something like that. And so I've got the goats, and I'm cleaning away the bushes and all of that. And they sneak over because they're like, hey, these grapes are better than thistles. And so they eat up his vineyard. But I'm responsible because I didn't keep my animals in. Or it could be that I set a fire. So that's the next one. Verse 6. If fire break out and catch in thorns, and so that's probably talking about the thorny shrubs that are used as hedgerows between the fields of different owners. So I've got a row of thorns on the edge of my field, and then I decide I want to get rid of those thorns because I bought the next field over. So I'm getting rid of that because I'm expanding my field. I was able to redeem maybe another field or whatever reason I have. So I burn those thorns, but I don't pay attention to the fire, and it catches my neighbor's field over here, and his field burns down. Well, then I'm responsible to pay for the damage that I've done. So in this case, it's my neighbor's property that's being damaged. It may be that I had a grudge against Pastor Scott, that we had gotten to a tiff about something, and so I wanted my goats to eat up his grapes as a way of getting revenge on him and being able to have plausible deniability, right? So this would be very difficult to prove ill intent. It could be that there was a malevolent spirit towards that person. It could be that it was just an accident. But damage has still been suffered by the owner of that field, and so restitution must still be made. And that's another lesson, even for you children, that sometimes you say, well, I didn't mean to do that, you know? I didn't mean to hurt my brother or sister. I didn't mean to break that. But you have to learn, and this is something that you parents need to teach your children, that there are consequences for our actions, even when we don't have ill intent. And of course, when we can prove that there's ill intent, the consequences are greater. But even when we didn't mean to do harm, there still are consequences. Now we come in verses 7 through 15 to disputes about liability for loss. Now, I learned a new English word in preparing for this lesson on these verses. And I'm going to teach it to you. That word is bailment. Maybe all of you knew it already, but I didn't. So bailment is an act of delivering goods to a bailee for a particular purpose. Without transfer of ownership, a contract of hire is a species of bailment. And so what bailment is, you know, I've got this book. Say, this is my book. And I'm going to give it to Brother Philemon for a particular reason. For whatever reason, Philemon is going to borrow my book. Now, it's still my book. I haven't given it to Philemon. I would never give my children's Bible storybook away. But he needed to borrow it. So he's borrowed it. And now it's at his house, right? And it's not at my house, but it still belongs to me. So Philemon is now my bailee. And I have engaged in a type of bailment with Philemon, right? So very simple. You borrow my book. So he has my book now. And I think I have a book of yours that I need to return to you as we're on that topic. In a world without banks or standardized currency, a world in which most possessions had to be fed and cared for, this would have been much more common in the ancient world than it is today. So, as far as I know, that book doesn't have to be fed. It doesn't have to have its manure changed, right? It's pretty easy to care for. You could just put the book on the shelf. I could leave the book on my shelf. It's pretty simple. But if my wealth is in the form not of dollars or cents or books on the shelf, but of animals that have to be cared for and need to be put to work, then things become a lot more complicated, right? So if you have money, you can just put the money in the bank. But if you don't have a bank and you don't have any coins and all you have is a bunch of animals, then who's taking care of the animals gets a little bit more complicated. And so if you have grain and you don't have a place to store grain, but you've got a place to store grain, maybe my barn isn't big enough for my grain, you can think of in an agricultural society, a non-industrial society like that, there's going to be a whole lot more situations where somebody else has somebody's stuff and is responsible for taking care of it. And with the exception of verse 9, which this is a quote from a commentator, which lays down a more general principle, this section deals with the stipulation governing various types of guardianship of another's movables or livestock and the degree of each bailee's responsibility. So the general principle is that liability increases with the benefit that the bailee receives or expects for his services or that he gains from the entrusted property. And so the more benefit, like, so if I give you something for safekeeping and the benefit is primarily to me that I want you to keep something safe, then you have less liability because you're doing me a favor. But if you borrow something from me for your benefit, you have more liability because I'm doing you a favor. So let's dig into this issue of bailment. Verse 7. If a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and if it be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he have put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. So I need somebody to steal my book from Philemon. Who wants to volunteer for that? See, Philip, go steal the book from Philemon. You're taking a nap, Philemon, or something. Aye. Philemon! Where's my book?
I don't know.
What happened to it? Did you steal it?
No, it was right here.
You stole my book. So Philemon and I are going to go to the judges. You can come with me to the judges. Let's Pastor John, you need to be the judge here. I'm going to bring my notes. I've got a case against Philemon. Judge Brother John, Philemon stole my book. I gave it to him to keep, and it's gone.
Where's your evidence?
Well, I gave it to him, and he doesn't have it, and he says that somebody stole it. Have you found this thief?
No.
No. You stole it, right? And so what's going to happen is if the thief be found, so I'm going to hunt for a thief. He says there was a thief. Look, here's the thief. You go down to the bookstore right now and get me two books because you need to pay me double because you stole the book and you made him look bad. You can keep the book again. You can't keep the book, but you can have it. Okay, we can all sit down now. All right, so if the thief be found, then he's supposed to pay double. But if the thief be not found, so he got away with it. He stole the book and he sold it to somebody in a far country and I never saw it again. Then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he have put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. And so John is going to cross-examine Philemon to see, is there any possibility maybe that you actually stole it? As we've noted earlier, just one point, the word that's translated as judges that we'll have occasion to see in more detail later is the Hebrew word Elohim, which in Hebrew is literally God as it is rendered in the ESV. So there's a question, should this be the judges? Should it be translated as judges? Should it be translated as God? It seems like a really big difference in translation, but in any case, it would be God's representatives, namely the priests or the judges or the Levites. And so actually in meaning is you're going to go before some competent authority who's going to make a decision. And so then, let's see, verse 8. And so if the thief is found, he's going to pay double. And if the thief be not found, then the judges are going to make a decision to see whether or not he's actually taken his neighbor's goods. If you haven't taken it, you're not liable. If you have taken it, well, then you've become a thief, so you're liable to pay double. Verse 9 interrupts the sequence of specific bailment disputes. So it's giving this list of particular scenarios, right? So if I give you my stuff and you say it got stolen, that's a scenario. And then it's going to go on and it's going to give us another specific scenario here in a few minutes. Well, here in a few verses, and we'll get to it in a few minutes. But then in verse 9, we get a general principle that lays down how to deal with property disputes. So for all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox or for ass or for sheep or for raiment or for any manner of lost thing, which another challengeth to be his. So any property dispute at all where something's gone and I say it's mine and you say it's yours or I say you took it and you say you didn't, for any property, any dispute like that, The cause of both parties shall come before the judges. You have the same translation issue there. And whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. And so the five and fourfold penalty was a special case of difficult to prove cattle rustling. And you saw this in the American West, that cattle rustling was dealt with very severely because it's easy to commit and difficult to catch. And so God, in God's law, there's never a capital payment. No one is put to death for property crime, but the punishment is very severe, and you wouldn't have to steal many oxen before you'd end up being sold as a slave and having to work for 7 years, which would be a significant deterrent. But the general principle is a double restitution to account for the time and trouble and expense. So even if I'm able to prove it, I've still had to stop what I'm doing and, you know, hunt for the thief, or I've had to go to court, I've had to deal with all of this, and so paying double accounts both for the original theft and for the trouble that the theft has caused. So then, in verse 10 through 13, we get additional details, an accusation of negligent care of livestock. So verse 10, if a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, and it die or be hurt or driven away, no man seeing it, then shall an oath of the Lord be between them both, that he hath not put his hand into his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. So I'm going to give this to somebody else, because my book disappeared when I gave it to you, so I'm not going to give you my donkey. I've got a donkey, and I've got to go on a trip. So I'm going to, who am I giving my donkey to? I'm going to give my donkey to Elijah. I'm going to say, Elijah, will you take care of my donkey and make sure it gets plenty of food and water? And I'll pay for the food and water, but I just want you to keep my donkey safe while I give this trip. I'm going to go to Seattle, and I want you to take care of my donkey while I'm gone. You take care of it? All right. Elijah, where's my donkey? What happened to it? I'm back from my trip. Where's the donkey? I need to get to work with my donkey. What happened? What? You what?
I said I still have it.
You still have it. So you have the donkey. So we're good. But let's say, wait. Okay, you have the donkey. But my donkey had four legs when I gave it to you. And now it has three legs. What happened to my donkey? And so you're going to be like, well, I don't know what happened to it. Nobody saw what happened. Something happened to this donkey. It got killed. It got hurt. It lost a leg. It got lame. Something happened to the donkey, and nobody saw it. Then shall an oath of the Lord be between them both, that he hath not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. So whatever happened to it, we're going to go before Pastor John, and we're going to take an oath to the Lord. I didn't have anything to do with this. Nobody saw it. There was no witness. There was nothing I could have done. I took all proper precautions with your animal. And it's going to be like, man, what am I going to do for a donkey now? I've got to, you know, go work for somebody else and earn some extra money or whatever. It just happened. You're not responsible because you were taking care of it for me, right? So you're doing me a favor. And as long as you exercise due diligence, then you're not liable for something that was outside of your control. You're not going to make it good. I'm just going to be sad about my donkey. But we get two other possibilities. If it be stolen from him, then he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. Now, this is in verse 12. It's not completely clear how this relates to the previous verses. Possibly from him means while he was watching, and is to be contrasted with the lack of eyewitnesses specified earlier. And so you have, if a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, and it die or be hurt or driven away, no man seeing it. So if you exercise due diligence and no one saw what happened, you're not liable. But if you were there and you didn't do anything to take care of it, well, now you are liable and you should make restitution because you didn't take care of it. So if you don't, so probably what it's saying is if you did witness it or you did have an opportunity to exercise diligence, you don't have to make double restitution, but you failed to keep your end of the bargain. And so now you've got to make it right. Like you get the three-legged donkey and you give me a new one that has four legs that I can, you know, put my books on as I, you know, go from the bookstore to my house and building my collection. And so it's a little tricky to know how that all connects, but I think that is what makes the most sense. If it be torn in pieces, then let him bring it for witness, and he shall not make good that which was torn. So presumably, if he witnessed it, then he was trying to recover some pieces of the torn animal. This is something, thus saith the Lord from the book of Amos, as the shepherd taketh out of the mouth of the lion two legs or a piece of an ear, so shall the children of Israel be taken out that dwell in Samaria in the corner of a bed and in Damascus in a couch. So the idea is here that if a lion came about and you did your best to deal with the lion, the fact that you have a leg of the lamb, and it's clear that it has, like, you know, lion stink on it, is evidence that you tried. You at least tracked the lion down. You tried to do what you could, but there was nothing that could be done. You couldn't stop the lion. You weren't David with your slingshot, and so the lamb was killed, and you don't owe me anything. You don't have to make that good. So a few puzzles there, but in general, the basic idea is clear. And so we're moving from something that I'm giving you something primarily for my benefit, right? I need you to keep something safe for me. But now, in verse 14, we turn to a situation where I'm giving you something for your benefit. So you're like, where'd my book go? You still have it. Okay, so let's do this the other way. So you need to come borrow it from me now.
Can I have your book? It's really cool.
Okay, here you go. All right, so now you're borrowing my book or my animal or my whatever I've got for your benefit. Well, now the situation has changed, right? Because I wasn't giving it to you to keep it safe for you. You came and got it from me because you needed it, right? You needed a tool that I had. While the others refer to situations in which one person is keeping property at the request of its owner, this refers to a situation in which someone asks to borrow something from its owner. Verse 14, if a man borrow aught from his neighbor, and it be hurt or die, the owner thereof being not with it, then he shall surely make it good. And so if you borrow something from me and it gets, I don't know how a book would die, but maybe it got thrown into the fire or something. But this is primarily talking about an agricultural society. There were more, you know, hides on the animals than there were around the bindings of books. But that's what we have here tonight. I could have brought some sheep and goats to illustrate, but that would have made Ruth's job a lot harder. So probably she's glad that I didn't do that. Ruth takes care of cleaning the auditorium, so that's why I would have made her job harder. And so if the owner is not with it, then he shall surely make it good. And so if you borrow something from me and you have it, then you are liable to make sure it gets back to me, even if something happens to it that you didn't cause, right? But if I'm with it, like, so if we're in a field working together and you borrow my donkey and I'm there with you, right, then I can see what happened to it, right? A lion jumped out of the thicket and started, you know, mauling on the donkey, and we both ran away. Well, then I could have dealt with the lion as much as you could have. So you're not liable because I should have jumped in and protected my donkey anyways, right? So the fact we both ran away, then you're not liable, and I've got a lion-eaten donkey, and I'm just out of donkey. So if the owner isn't still present, though, the one who borrowed it, verse 15, but if the owner thereof be with it, he shall not make it good. If it be an hired thing, it came for his hire. If the owner is present, perhaps we should imagine them working a field together. Nothing is owed, since the owner himself could have intervened to stop the disaster had intervention been possible. Now, I'm going to skip verses 16 and 17 and come back to them next week when we don't have generations combined, and so we'll come back to that. Verses 18 through 20, we have the capital crimes. So remember I mentioned the section begins with capital crimes, and if you read those verses, you can see why I'm doing that. And so with the capital crimes, at the beginning, we had the capital crimes such as murder and assault on parents. So that was dealt with at the beginning of the section. And now we have another list of crimes for which the penalty is at least potentially death. And that wraps this section of legal judgment together. While some relate these verses to the section that follows, it seems better to see these three verses as a return to the capital crimes, pardon me, with which the section began, marking an end of the section. And when the two are taken together, it becomes clear that capital crimes are those, that is, crimes for which the penalty is death, are those that relate to three areas. Intentional disregard for human life. So murder and kidnapping both carry the death penalty. An intentional revolt against the creational order, such as witchcraft and bestiality, carried the death penalty. And an intentional revolt against the covenantal order, dishonoring or striking one's parents and sacrificing to a false god. So the penalties in this section, there are others in other parts of the law, but in this section of Scripture, it is a revolt against the creation, intentional disregard for human life and intentional disregard for the creational and the covenantal order that sustains human life. Those were the sins that were the crimes that judges should execute the death penalty on. Verse 18, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Witchcraft is that which seeks to manipulate the natural order by accessing supernatural forces. And while most witchcraft or magic or occultism that you see is entirely fake, there is real power in some areas of the occult. Right? There is demonic power. Most people who claim to be accessing demonic power are not actually accessing any power at all. They're simply accessing the power of trickery to access your pocketbook. But there is real demonic power in the world, and it is absolutely forbidden to God's people to participate in that power in any way, shape, or form. You cannot use evil power for good. And that's one of the things that I really like about The Lord of the Rings. Some people are leery of The Lord of the Rings because in that story, there's all these sorts of powers and different things and wizards and all of this stuff. But if you actually read the story, and many of you I know have, the overwhelming message supports what the Bible teaches, that you cannot use these evil powers for good purposes, because if you try, you're corrupted by those powers. And that's really the whole point of the Ring of Sauron, that those who seek to use it for good are corrupted by the power they've sought to access, and that humans should only use the power that God has given to them and should not try to access angelic or demonic power for their own purposes. Deuteronomy 18 gives more detail on this prohibition. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not learn to do after the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For those that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord. Because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. Thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God, for these nations which thou shalt possess hearkened unto observers of times and unto diviners, but as for thee, the Lord thy God hath not suffered thee so to do. So as C.S. Lewis, any participation in the occult, whether it's fake occultism or real occultism, is absolutely prohibited to God's people. But there's something else here that we should pay attention to, and that's C.S. Lewis wrote a brilliant little essay on magic and technology. Because really the heart, if you study old magical texts, what they're attempting to do is they're attempting to manipulate the natural order for their own purposes. That's the goal of magic. That's the goal of alchemy. That's the goal of all of this stuff. And that's the goal of so much of our modern technology. It isn't to work with the grain of nature. It isn't to restore nature. It isn't to take dominion over nature. It is an assault on the purposes of nature to force it by raw power to do what we want it to do. And that's something we should really think in any situation where there's a given technology, where there's a given maybe practice. Is this something that is that magic mindset that seeks to force nature to do our own bidding? Or is this something that seeks to work with the grain of the universe and to take dominion over the world as God has intended? And so that's something like even one of the things that it seems to me the clearest is strip coal mining, where they take all the surface of the earth off, they destroy all the vegetation, everything is destroyed, the streams are polluted just so they can get the coal out, versus other methods of mining that may preserve the natural environment. And so we're not called to be extreme, extreme environmentalists that say, you know, nature is somehow sacred and we should not gain any benefit from it. That's not the biblical perspective, but a perspective that says we're going to simply destroy nature to get what we want and to force it to do our will is one that is not compatible with the biblical story because it's not compatible with this prohibition of this forcing nature, forcing the creational order to do our bidding. And so that's something to reflect on and to think about in different particular details. Verse 19, whosoever lieth with a beast shall surely be put to death. Bestiality is another attack on the natural order, namely the distinction between men and animals is also a capital crime. And verse 20, he that sacrifices unto any god, save unto the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. This is the penalty that was meted out to Canaan, and it involves not only death, but also the total destruction of all of a person's property as well. So that brings us to the end, with the exception of those verses we'll come back to. That brings us to the end of this section that gives a legal principles for wisdom in a variety of particular situations. Any questions about anything that we've covered? Father, I come before you. I thank you for how good you are. I thank you for your word. And I pray, Father, Lord, that we would learn from your word how to live our lives in wise ways that reflect your beauty and your holiness, that reflect your goodness. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.